suit filed by Cordova Fishermen United. United Fishermen of Alaska, a Kodiak biologist and a Prince William Sound fisherman, alleges the department has failed to adhere to a 1990 law requiring specific spill response plans. The suit says the agency has fallen short on several fronts, including its inadequate plans for response outside of Prince William Sound, failure to require sufficient spill response equipment, inability to deal with a tanker fire away from dock, and ineffective tanker escorts. DEC lawyer Breck Tostevin says the plaintiffs are basically asking for the court to circumvent the DEC's own review process of claims first filed by fishermen in an administrative appeal last year. Tostevin says the suit, which also alleges that the DEC has been conferring illegally with the oil industry on the spill response rules, asked the court to review the plan's status and stop the DEC from approving them.
Practical result is that if the contingency plan approvals are stayed, then there could not be shipment of oil from the Valdez terminal legally.
Tostevin says the judge will look at the suit in two parts and could grant the review without the tanker stopping stay. He says there is no precedent where the court has cut short the DEC's own review process to replace it with the court's. But United Fishermen of Alaska President Jerry McCune says the DEC has been stonewalling for too long on too vital an issue.
We just want to safeguard our backyard and make sure that the contingency plans are up to where they promised they would be. And we're not out to stop the flow of oil or put anybody out of work or do anything else. We just want a ruling on where these contingency plans are where they're supposed to be.
McCune says if the suit is rejected by the court, they'll be forced to deal with the DEC process, which has already burned up 14 months since their concerns were first filed. Tostevin is preparing the DEC's response brief. It's due November 21st, after which the court has 10 days to decide whether or what parts of the suit it will hear. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Moses Cruikshank definitely bridged two cultures and was well known for his storytelling skills. In one interview from the Oral History Archives of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, he spoke of his time as a boy attending St. Mark's Mission in Nenana, where all the students had jobs.
And my job all the time was with the dogs. And since I was interested in dogs, and I liked dogs, you know, I took good care of them. So that was my steady job, dog boy.
In summers, Cruikshank helped Hudson Stuck during the Archdeacon's river trips. In winter, he accompanied other ministers on dog trips, where once the tent was up, he tended the team.
So while the minister is cooking in there, well, I start up the dog feed. Melt snow. So it's melted, well, I put in my fish. And the snow starts boiling, then I put in the rice. Rice and fish cook, and after we know just how much to put in there because we've done it so many times, you know. Sometimes you don't put enough, it's just thin, it's no good. Sometimes you put too much, it burns. Dogs don't want burnt feed, they don't want to eat it. So you have to watch, you see that you have the right amount of fish and right amount of rice in there, and don't burn it, yeah.
Once the dogs were fed, Cruikshank's work turned to the books.
Then I have to study for about over half an hour, reading, writing, arithmetic. I got to study that. And then I close up the tent real good for the night. And then I put in a couple of big chunks of wood inside the stove and adjust the draft so it'll keep for a long time, you know. And then make shavings and everything, so we have fire in the morning. And after that, we say our prayers. Then we hit the sack. And it seems like I just get the sack and get straightened out, and then I hear an alarm go off. Early in the morning, we had to get up. Yeah.
In addition to running dogs, Cruikshank helped build the Alaska Railroad and saved enough money to attend prep school in Massachusetts. He also prospected for gold for the FE Company, became a sergeant during World War II, and headed up construction of new housing in Beaver. A school in Beaver bears his name. Upon retirement, he moved to Fairbanks, where he worked at WICA as a foster grandparent. Supervisor Faith Taves says for 12 years, Cruikshank served as a calming force for children who came to WICA from broken homes.
He was just a real consistent, calm, positive adult male role model, and particularly for the Native children because of his own Native heritage and background. It was a real comforting presence for children, that especially those that came here from villages.
Cruikshank leaves a long list of survivors all across interior Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Last spring, the state Senate passed a bill that would have raised tobacco taxes $1 a pack. Smoking is a leading cause of cancer, and a broad segment of the public supported the tax, arguing that if cigarettes are more expensive, fewer children will smoke. The bill died in the House when Speaker Gayle Phillips refused to back down on her pledge to oppose any tax increases. On today's Front Porch, we'll talk about how the candidates stand on the tobacco tax. Then in Part 2, one voter asks how incumbents can raise their own pay while leaning hard on the wages paid to other state employees. First, though, let's talk taxes.
Hi, my name is Kathy Dietrich, and I'm in District 29. My question is, based upon the fact that there was bipartisan and community support for the $1 a pack tobacco tax, would you support a tobacco tax in the next legislative session? Please explain why. Thank you.
This is Jeanette James from District 34. After discussing the tobacco tax with the people this summer, I have found that the overwhelming bipartisan and community support for the tobacco tax was not as passionate and enthusiastic as was touted by the special interests in Juneau. Although my reasons for opposing the tax are still valid, I will support a tobacco tax provided that the money goes into the pre-statehood dedicated school fund. This dedicated fund is already available and can be used only for school construction and rehabilitation. These needs are every bit as serious as those reasons claimed to support the tobacco tax.
This is Eric Holland. I'm running for District 31, and I support the tobacco tax, although I am uncomfortable with some of the health arguments advanced for it. I support it simply because it is a popular and practical way to raise revenue.
Hi, Bob Boko, District 30, State House. A tax is a tax. It has been documented that even though the cost of cigarettes is high, people will still buy them. Kids are now buying cigarettes on the black market for $7 a pack. This money, when collected, goes to the general fund, not to the fund, not the funding of health problems created by cigarettes.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, running for House District 30. I initially went into last session opposing it. After about a month or two of constant contact with the people back in Fairbanks, I definitely have changed my mind. There was about 200-1 in favor for the tax, so that's why I support that.
This is David Mollett, running for State House in District 33. I would definitely support an increase in the tobacco tax. An increase to $1 may be too much at this time, but since it is scientifically proven that higher prices deter young people from smoking, it is obvious that this tax would benefit everyone.
This is Paul Chismar. I'm running for State House in District 33. The buzzword for the tobacco tax is it's for the children, when in reality it is a tax to enrich the state coffers and to claim the dubious distinction of having the largest tobacco tax in the United States. This is spelled out in the long-range fiscal plan. Much is said about health costs due to tobacco, but what about health costs of people running, jogging, skiing, and so on, who in an effort to become healthy are constantly seeking medical care for knee injuries, muscle injuries, and other disorders? Should they also be taxed to control health costs?
Hello, this is Representative John Davies, candidate in District 29. I support an increase in the tobacco tax. Tobacco use is the leading cause of death in Alaska. Tobacco use kills more people than AIDS, alcohol, cocaine, heroin, murders, car accidents, fires, and suicides combined. The American Cancer Society estimates that the proposed $1 tax increase would reduce youth smoking in Alaska by 32%. Increasing tobacco taxes is widely recognized as the single most effective way to discourage tobacco use in young people. I would use the revenue to support public health programs aimed at prevention.
Bonnie Williams, I'm the candidate, the Republican candidate for House District 29. No, I will not support any new tax or tax increase. A lot of the tobacco tax support stems from anti-smoking. Taxes should only be used to raise revenue, not control behavior. Unfortunately, a $1 tax per pack won't stop youth illegally smoking, but it will produce a major criminal black market problem, as Canada has discovered, leading to their discontinuing their tax increase within a year of its imposition.
Hi, my name is David Guttenberg, and I'm a candidate for a state Senate District O. And yes, I do support a tobacco tax. This is an issue that goes directly to the health of our children. And the benefit comes from a higher tobacco tax comes from the lower long-term health care costs and higher quality of life that results from lower tobacco usage. Thank you.
This is Gary Wilkin, Senate seat O. I view the issue of tobacco use in our society not as a tax issue, but as a health and welfare issue. I'll support a tobacco tax, but only if it addresses two major considerations. One, it provides an effective economic disincentive to purchase tobacco products, and two, it funds education. With patience and with a solid education program, I believe Alaskans can and should take the lead in becoming America's first smoke-free state.
This is Ron Gould, candidate for Senate seat Q. I'm in favor of the dollar a pack tobacco tax. I would specifically hope that all funds from this could be directed back to prevention issues regarding tobacco, health care issues, and the health industry and the people who are affected by the tobacco itself, so that it is used back in the arena from which the problems have occurred. I also think the state should become involved in the litigation lawsuit against the tobacco companies, as 19 other states are so far.
Hi, my name is Jim Chumbly, my voting district 31. I would like to pose a question for incumbents of the House and Senate candidates as to how they can justify a pay raise for themselves while they're trying to trim the budget and especially come down hard on other state employees.
This is Jeanette James from District 34. I believe Alaskans' expect per diem should cover the cost of living for legislators and their family during the 4 months away in Juneau. They are off their regular job, and expenses include the cost of their maintaining their home within their district too. Per diem equal to the amount allowed for federal employees is appropriate. The intense attention required to the legislative process should not be inhibited by worries about where the next meal will come from. Although some legislators' expenses are not as much as others, anyone should be able to be one of our citizen legislators, not just those who can afford it. They should not be expected to pay their living expenses with savings or other personal income.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, running for re-election to District 30. I cannot justify a pay raise for the legislature. I thought it was unfounded, and at the time it was put into place, I was the first person to speak against it. As a matter of fact, I turned over $11,000 of that money back to the community PTAs, sports associations, and so forth.
Hello, this is Representative John Davies, candidate in District 29. I did not initiate nor vote for the increase in per diem. Also, I don't think that public employees' wages and benefits should be cut. Rather, we should support the development of private sector jobs that pay well. I took a significant pay cut when I resigned from the university after being elected. Juneau is an expensive place to live. Even with the increased per diem, my family and I are struggling to make ends meet. I believe the per diem rate is justifiable.
That's it for today's Front Porch. Remember, if you have a question for the candidates, please call KUIC at 474-7491. I'm John McWhorter. The state estimates 10,000 people currently receiving aid to families with dependent children will one day be ineligible. That means more people will be looking for work. One caller wants to know how lawmakers will fill in the gaps. In our second question, a caller wonders about candidate positions on ballot measure 3, the ban on same-day airborne wolf hunting. Currently, people holding a trapping license can shoot wolves after flying, provided they first walk 100 yards from their plane. Critics say this is an open invitation for hunters to violate the ethics of fair chase. Opponents argue that land and shoot hunting is already illegal and that the initiative is an end run around the Board of Game and its public process. Again, only a few candidates responded. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Suze Kiskin, and I'm in District 29. My question is on the Wolf Initiative, Proposition 3. The ad supporting this initiative sounds like everyone should support it. But if this initiative is so good, why have 59 professional Alaskan biologists signed a bill opposing it? Don't you think there's something fishy about this Wolf Initiative? Thank you.
I am Jeanette James from District 34. There are two ways to make decisions, emotionally and rationally. Personally, I prefer to make rational decisions. Proposition 3 proposes an emotional solution, so of course their advertising will be warm, fuzzy, and emotional appealing. But life is not just a bed of roses with feel-good solutions. Wolves are not the only animal we need to consider. You cannot leave the needs of man out of the equation. Is there something fishy about this initiative? Probably it is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
This is Gary Wilkin, candidate for CETO. Suze, thanks for the question. The ads we see are misleading because they leave the impression that Alaskan hunters and trappers are shooting predators from moving aircraft. That's not the case. Current law clearly forbids it. And currently, wolf populations are thriving at the expense of our consumable game population. Alaska Fish and Game statistics show that hunters take 3% of the consumable game, while predators take 90%. This proposition should be defeated because it is not based on good science, as witnessed by these 59 biologists. Our Constitution requires Alaskans manage our fish and game for sustained yield. We should let the professionals do exactly that and remove the emotion and politics from this issue.
This is Representative John Davies, District 29. While I appreciate some of the goals of the advocates for Proposition 3, I have serious misgivings about the management of fish and game by initiative. I don't think the legislature should involve itself in the allocation issues either. The more we allow the board process to work, the better. I think we should reconvene the 1991 wolf management team and try to establish a consensus on wolf management.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, running for State House District 30. I think the initiative... I'm Representative Tom Bryce, District 30. I think the initiative process was used to address a very volatile political question, namely wolf control, which is what the question's about. And it's brought about by citizens who are honestly concerned. I think it is best, though, that these types of decisions are taken away from the political arena and addressed by the Board of Game, where proper management decisions can be made.
This is Claudia Douglas, a candidate for State House in District 32. Again, thanks for the question. At this time, I'm not supporting Proposition 3. Again, I think that it would limit control and management by the Department of Fish and Game, and I just think that we need to control our resources.
Hi, this is David Guttenberg, and I'm a candidate for Senate District L. And I support sound managed scientific management of Alaska's resources, so I'm concerned about putting resource management on a ballot in the form of an initiative. I don't think the ballot is a proper place to make resource management or allocation decisions, and the issue of management becomes a popularity contest in that circumstance and may prevent a later change in policy due to unforeseen circumstances. Whether it's this one or another down the road, I think we need to keep management and allocation off the ballot.
Hello, my name is Robin Martin. My house district is 29. Now that welfare as we know it is ending, how will the state handle the families in which the parents are still unemployed? For example, if Irving's family with three children would have to pay up to $8 an hour for child care, which makes it unrealistic for the parents to take anything less than $13 per hour. I know this is tempered a bit by daycare assistance, but even that program isn't unlimited. Now, how should the state and the marketplace and perhaps even the schools prepare for all these families being pushed off the dole now?
This is Jeanette James from District 34. The welfare system, as we know it, was too rigid. Recipients had to be without anything to get any assistance, and even with the jobs program, it was difficult to make the giant step off the system. We can have a more flexible system. People should be able to get some help without quitting their job or getting rid of their assets, and to be able to phase themselves back to self-sufficiency. Dependency destroys the soul. Welfare as we know it will be replaced with opportunity. With opportunity, people will rise to the occasion. With welfare reform, we should all be shouting, "Free at last!" The new system still provides a way to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves.
This is Gary Wilkin, candidate for Senate seat Robin, thanks for the question. I don't know much about the welfare system, but I'll certainly learn. The recent federal changes have thrown our state system into turmoil, but that's not bad because control of welfare is coming back to Alaska and closer to the people, which I strongly favor. We should welcome the challenge to design a fair and equitable welfare system for our citizens. While I'm learning about how to structure our new welfare system to provide for those that are truly in need, I'll also be working hard to diversify the Alaskan economy to provide Alaskans with as many jobs as possible.
This is Representative John Davies, District 29. The welfare reform bills passed by Congress and the Alaska legislature are substantially similar. They both have as their main goal getting people back to work. They both suffer from arbitrary time limits. They both will need three major programs to be successful: effective job training, increased daycare assistance, and affordable basic health care.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, District 30. I've been very involved in addressing the question of welfare reform over the past 4 years. I think most importantly, we got to ensure that families have a very basic safety net. We must reinvest part of the savings into programs like daycare and health care to ensure that the people who are going to be moved off welfare have the proper tools to be employed.
This is Claudia Douglas, and I'm a candidate for State House in District 32. Although I have some concerns about the welfare reform effort that was passed not only in our state but nationally, I do believe that it's a good idea to get people from welfare to work. As long as we're going to make sure that there is good daycare for families that are in need of assistance, that we have health care that's available and affordable for all Alaskans, and then also that we have some training or retraining opportunities for people that are sort of forced into that position.
Hi, this is David Guttenberg, candidate for Senate District O. I've long believed that the best social service program is a good job, and I believe that by preparing people through quality education and vocational training, our children should have the potential to live better lives. But the jobs must be available. And with that job must come a reasonable expectation of being able to take care of their families. It's a larger decision of community health that is answered by having reasonable expectations. The economy must grow, and we must have an infrastructure that allows that to happen.
That's it for this week's Front Porch. If possible, we'll have one more chance for candidate questions before Election Day. Send your question in by calling Front Porch at 474-7491. I'm John McWhorter. The state estimates 10,000 people currently receiving aid to families with dependent children will one day be ineligible. That means more people will be looking for work. One caller wants to know how lawmakers will fill in the gaps. In our second question, a caller wonders about candidate positions on ballot measure 3, the ban on same-day airborne wolf hunting. Currently, people holding a trapping license can shoot wolves after flying, provided they first walk 100 yards from their plane. Critics say this is an open invitation for hunters to violate the ethics of fair chase. Opponents argue that land and shoot hunting is already illegal and that the initiative is an end run around the Board of Game and its public process. Again, only a few candidates responded. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Suze Kiskin, and I'm in District 29. My question is on the Wolf Initiative, Proposition 3. The ad supporting this initiative sounds like everyone should support it. But if this initiative is so good, why have 59 professional Alaskan biologists signed a bill opposing it? Don't you think there's something fishy about this wolf initiative? Thank you.
I'm Jeanette James from District 34. There are two ways to make decisions, emotionally and rationally. Personally, I prefer to make rational decisions. Proposition 3 proposes an emotional solution, so of course their advertising will be warm, fuzzy, and emotional appealing. But life is not just a bed of roses with feel-good solutions. Wolves are not the only animal we need to consider. You cannot leave the needs of man out of the equation. Is there something fishy about this initiative? Probably it is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
This is Gary Wilkin, candidate for seat O. Suze, thanks for the question. The ads we see are misleading because they leave the impression that Alaskan hunters and trappers are shooting predators for moving aircraft. That's not the case. Current law clearly forbids it. And currently, wolf populations are thriving at the expense of our consumable game population. Alaska Fish and Game statistics show that hunters take 3% of the consumable game, while predators take 90%. This proposition should be defeated because it is not based on good science, as witnessed by these 59 biologists. Our Constitution requires Alaskans manage our fish and game for sustained yield. We should let the professionals do exactly that and remove the emotion and politics from this issue.
This is Representative John Davies, District 29. While I appreciate some of the goals of the advocates for Proposition 3, I have serious misgivings about the management of fish and game by initiative. I don't think the legislature should involve itself in the allocation issues either. The more we allow the board process to work, the better. I think we should reconvene the 1991 wolf management team and try to establish a consensus on wolf management.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, District 30. I think the initiative process was used to address a very volatile political question, namely wolf control, which is what the question's about. And it's brought about by citizens who are honestly concerned. I think it is best, though, that these types of decisions are taken away from the political arena and addressed by the Board of Game, where proper management decisions can be made.
This is Claudia Douglas, a candidate for State House in District 32. Again, thanks for the question. At this time, I'm not supporting Proposition 3. Again, I think that it would limit control and management by the Department of Fish and Game, and I just think that we need to control our resources.
Hi, this is David Guttenberg, and I'm a candidate for Senate District L. And I support sound managed scientific management of Alaska's resources, so I'm concerned about putting resource management on a ballot in the form of an initiative. I don't think the ballot is a proper place to make resource management or allocation decisions, and the issue of management becomes a popularity contest in that circumstance and may prevent a later change in policy due to unforeseen circumstances. Whether it's this one or another down the road, I think we need to keep management and allocation off the ballot.
Hello, my name is Robin Martin. My house district is 29. Now that welfare as we know it is ending, how will the state handle the families in which the parents are still unemployed? For example, a Fairbanks family with three children would have to pay up to $8 an hour for child care, which makes it unrealistic for the parents to take anything less than $13 per hour. I know this is tempered a bit by daycare assistance, but even that program isn't unlimited. Now, how should the state and the marketplace, and perhaps even the schools, prepare for all these families being pushed off the dole now?
This is Jeanette James from District 34. The welfare system, as we know it, was too rigid. Recipients had to be without anything to get any assistance, and even with the jobs program, it was difficult to make the giant step off the system. We can have a more flexible system. People should be able to get some help without quitting their job or getting rid of their assets, and to be able to phase themselves back to self-sufficiency. Dependency destroys the soul. Welfare as we know it will be replaced with opportunity. With opportunity, people will rise to the occasion. With welfare reform, we should all be shouting, "Free at last!" The new system still provides a way to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves.
This is Gary Wilkin, candidate for Senate seat. Robin, thanks for the question. I don't know much about the welfare system, but I'll certainly learn. The recent federal changes have thrown our state system into turmoil, but that's not bad because control of welfare is coming back to Alaska and closer to the people, which I strongly favor. We should welcome the challenge to design a fair and equitable welfare system for our citizens. While I'm learning about how to structure our new welfare system to provide for those that are truly in need, I'll also be working hard to diversify the Alaskan economy to provide Alaskans with as many jobs as possible.
This is Representative John Davies, District 29. The welfare reform bills passed by Congress and the Alaska legislature are substantially similar. They both have as their main goal getting people back to work. They both suffer from arbitrary time limits. They both will need three major programs to be successful: effective job training, increased daycare assistance, and affordable basic health care.
I'm Representative Tom Bryce, District 30. I've been very involved in addressing the question of welfare reform over the past 4 years. I think most importantly, we got to ensure that families have a very basic safety net. We must reinvest part of the savings into programs like daycare and health care to ensure that the people who are going to be moved off welfare have the proper tools to be employed.
This is Claudia Douglas, and I'm a candidate for State House in District 32. Although I have some concerns about the welfare reform effort that was passed not only in our state but nationally, I do believe that it's a good idea to get people from welfare to work. As long as we're going to make sure that there is good daycare for families that are in need of assistance, that we have health care that's available and affordable for all Alaskans, and then also that we have some training or retraining opportunities for people that are sort of forced into that position.
Hi, this is David Guttenberg, candidate for Senate District O. I've long believed that the best social service program is a good job, and I believe that by preparing people through quality education and vocational training, our children should have the potential to live better lives. But the jobs must be available. And with that job must come a reasonable expectation of being able to take care of their families. It's a larger decision of community health that is answered by having reasonable expectations. The economy must grow, and we must have an infrastructure that allows that to happen.
That's it for this week's Front Porch. If possible, we'll have one more chance for candidate questions before Election Day. Send your question in by calling Front Porch at 474-7491. I'm John McWhorter.
Deion Alexander's a 21-year-old who left his school in Fort Yukon when he was a teenager. He says trouble with the law distracted him, and he quit after the 11th grade. He's been busy for the past 3 years, hunting and fishing and fighting fires in the summer. Education didn't cross his mind much until he heard about the alternative school opening in Fort Yukon. He jumped at the chance to get his diploma at this school, which treats him like an adult.
You could do what you want in there, you know, drink coffee, or you know, use the bathroom anytime you want, as long as you get your work done and get something accomplished today. And then the next day, this goes on. You know, as long as you just get your credits, come to school.
The alternative school's three rooms are nestled along with the gym in what's called the center by locals. It's a large warehouse-looking building right next to the squeaky new school, which replaced the one destroyed by fire last year. But even before classes began, teacher Marcia Johnson says the students tackled their first project. They cleaned and renovated the abandoned classrooms.
It was really like a free-for-all where everything had just been dumped. But our first week in school, we had the school district sponsored a vocational ed painting class. Four of the students in the alternative school enrolled in that class, and they stripped the walls in two of the rooms and painted the whole area that we use as the daycare and the classroom. And if you came now, you would not believe the difference. I mean, they did an outstanding job. The wonderful thing about it is the kids are so proud of the work that they did themselves.
Johnson says the painting project gave the students a sense of ownership, and now they're choosing a school mascot and colors. In addition to the 9 students listed on this school's enrollment sheet are the names of 3 babies aged 4 to 18 months. Johnson says this school's designed for students who have their own kids.
Students, whether they're parents or not, we have some parents and some that are not, and I think that they're learning a lot of incidental parenting skills just by through observation of the infant care worker. We're not just a babysitting service. We are providing learning for the children that attend the daycare. We keep the door open to the daycare most of the time. And the kids, you know, can just see her interacting with the kids. And so I think it really reinforces a lot of parenting skills without formal instruction.
Johnson says the alternative school format lifts some restrictions built into the mainstream educational system. Instead of desks, students work at tables. They don't have a schedule and can choose what courses they want to work on each day. The emphasis is on mastering skills, not seat time. Johnson's also working on setting students up with jobs where they can earn credit while they work. Alternative School Advisory Board member Bonnie Carroll says at first she was wary of the alternative school idea, but now she's a fan of the program because she's seeing results.
5 of the students that are enrolled have already earned some credit, 4 through the vocational education program, and 1 completed work for credit in math. In the short time that these students have been enrolled, they've seen a drastic improvement in the reading and math skills of several students.
And Carol says she's really looking forward to graduation because one of her own children will be walking down the aisle this May, thanks to the alternative school. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
After years of environmental impact studies, plans are being finalized for the construction of 2.5 miles of road from the visitor center at Portage Glacier Recreation Area off the Seward Highway to Whittier. Jerry George is working on final permitting for the State Department of Transportation.
We were able to shorten up the bridges and move away from some of the salmon spawning beds and other things like that. So the tentative approvals we had from the agencies, now we're going in and getting those finalized.
George doesn't expect much feedback on the latest changes. As he says, most shift development away from fragile areas, including a tunnel which will divert the road out of Portage Lake and the view shed. That tunnel, a following section of road into Bear Valley, and the conversion of the existing railroad tunnel to dual use comprise the project's first phase.
And we should be able to start that work this winter and finish the work up next summer if everything, you know, comes together as we hope in the next month here.
That could be difficult. Awaiting review is a suit seeking to stop the road's construction filed by 3 Alaska environmental and tourism groups led by the law firm Trustees for Alaska. Trustees attorney Pat Lavin says the road plan violates several federal laws.
But the main one is known as Section 4F of the Department of Transportation Act, and it says that the Department of Transportation, which includes the Federal Highway Administration, cannot spend federal money on a transportation project through a public park unless there's no feasible and prudent alternative. So our argument is that upgrading the existing rail shuttle is actually a feasible and prudent alternative and wouldn't involve taking using the parklands.
Lavin and the state are pushing for a court review which would look at the trustee suit and a Federal Highway Administration request for its dismissal. But in the meantime, the DOT's George says it's full speed ahead on the road, a statement that seems contradictory to the trustee's Lavin.
Everything from the state makes it sound like everything's moving forward very quickly, but the papers that the Federal Highway Administration files in court all insist that it'll be a long time before anything happens. In fact, their motion to dismiss, the whole argument is that the decision to build the road isn't even final.
Lavin's claims and the suit are discounted by George as pure selfishness on the part of a few. George says the situation is hard to believe after spending $3.5 million on the environmental impact statement alone.
Not too long ago, we could build a new road for $1 million a mile, and it costs more than $1 million a mile now just to get the permits. You know, we've gone through that entire process, and we're still faced with a lawsuit.
With no date set for a court review, George says the DOT plans to put out bids for beginning road construction after permits expected to come through this month are approved. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross. The Eyak Nation of Prince William Sound held its second potlatch in over 90 years Saturday in Valdez. The gathering served to revive the Eyak Nation and to begin new traditions. Shauna Simmons has more. Coming down in 3, 2, 1.
And
area natives gathered to enjoy the dancing and drumming of the sleeping lady dancers at the potlatch. It was part of the International Peace and Dignity Journey, a movement that combines ancient prophecy, current native teachings, and a message of goodwill. Runners left Chickaloon Village in May carrying the IAC Holy Staff. The run culminated in Mexico City on October 12th, and Saturday's potlatch celebrated the return of the staff to Alaska by Yuma, Arizona activist and adopted IAC, Joseph Michaud.
What we did here is that it was asleep for a while, and we woke it back up again. And we're going to put it back to sleep again tonight for rest, and then it will travel throughout Alaska on villages' request, the people's request.
Michaud was instrumental in getting Alaska's indigenous peoples involved in the peace and dignity journey. He says the movement is a way for indigenous peoples of all nations to share their beliefs and traditions and honor their elders. IAC Chief Marie Smith, the only living full-blooded IAC and the last native speaker of the IAC language, says that fits right into the message she's been teaching.
I have been an activist for about 5 years, and I have been traveling around to try to get people to love one another again one more time before I'm gone.
At the potlatch, Smith held a naming ceremony to give IAC names to friends and family members.
They are adopted into the IAC Nation, and I am very proud to do this because IAC Nation is growing. And wherever I travel, people have come up to me and asked me if I will give them a name. So I'm a very proud old lady because our nation is getting bigger.
Smith says she's sorry she never taught her children to speak the IAC language, and now it's too late. She advises adults to teach their language and culture to their children. Her message to young people is to listen to your elders and be proud of who you are. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Shauna Simmons.
The 1997 Teacher of the Year for Alaska. The honor for the Bush Elementary School teacher was announced last Tuesday by the State Department of Education. She now goes on to represent Alaska in the national competition. Let me cue this up here. 2, 1. Walking down the hall of the McGrath School, it's not difficult to find Judy Kuhn's combined kindergarten and first grade class. It's the room where the winter snow boots lined up neatly against the wall just outside the door. Above the boots, at a first grader's eye level, a row of small posters are taped to the wall, each featuring a picture of a student and a short handwritten paragraph describing what they would do if they were president of the United States. In the classroom, the desks have been pushed together in groups of 4 and 6. The 24 kids in her class are also in groups, completing assignments with varying degrees of concentration. The conversations are lively, but not rowdy. Judy moves from one student to the next, solving problems and offering encouragement.
Okay, now there's two kinds of what. There's this one. There's also another. Say the word whale and see if you hear any breath coming.
Whale.
When you feel breath come out, what do you know it is? You know it's W-H.
Judy has been teaching in McGrath since 1985. Before that, she worked as an aide, counselor, and substitute teacher in Antioch. She says she likes to get her students involved in their subjects.
My philosophy is that if you want a child to understand something, they have to work through it and they have to do it to learn it. You can't just show them a book, you can't show them a picture, you can't just tell them about it. They have to get their hands dirty. They have to move it. They have to shake it. They have to hear it. They have to experience with it to really understand something. So that's my philosophy, that you have to get involved in it. You have to make it yours to understand it.
Last Tuesday, Judy was called out of her class to take a phone call. When she answered the phone, she was stunned to hear the voice of Governor Tony Knowles.
The governor said he wanted to call personally to inform Judy that she was selected Alaska's Teacher of the Year and also to congratulate her on a job well done. The conversation was a brief one.
So I said, well, listen, I said, I got a room full of kids. I can't talk. I got to go. And then I hung up. I came over. I was so nervous. I was shaking. I said to the kids, the governor called. They said, why did he call you? I said, well, he called to tell me I was Teacher of the Year. And so they all gave me big hugs, and they bowled me over. We were down on the floor. They were giving me hugs. They knocked me over.
Her students are her first priority, and no one who knows Judy would be surprised to hear that she hung up on the governor so she could hurry back to class. Don Christie team teaches the fourth grade class at McGrath School. She says Judy Kuhn's teaching skills are especially in tune with kids who live in the bush.
She really gets a feel for her children and senses what makes children click. And so because of that and because of her, part of her that's so much, you know, she feels so much for kids, she understands them. She knows what makes them work. And she, everything in her classroom is something that just makes things come alive for kids. And she just makes the whole environment that we live in part of their education.
Don Christie, fourth grade team teacher at McGrath School. Judy Kuhn has made the learning experience an especially fun one for her students.
But that's how it is in this classroom. Everything, every day is funny. We got funny things. We're just laughing because of the way kids look at things. And the things they say and the things they write, we're just in stitches in here all the time. And that's exactly why I love this age and love teaching, is because when you see the world through these kids' eyes, it's a whole new place. It's a beautiful place, and they're so excited about learning.
Judy Kuhn, the combined kindergarten and first grade teacher at McGrath School, the 1997 Alaska Teacher of the Year. Reporting in McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
All types of users, from horseback riders and hikers to snow machiners and cross-country skiers, visit Denali State Park each year, and it's up to the Division of Parks to keep them all happy. Part of that job means making regulations restricting who can go where. Northern Park Superintendent Anna Plager says proposed regulations would close certain areas of the high country to snow machines and some rivers to airboats. But she says planners do recognize that this will be controversial.
The director of state parks has asked each of the park managers, like myself, all around the state, what areas could be opened to motorized use to try and lessen the sense of being singled out and give more of a feeling of welcome to all the types of users of state parks. And we have submitted, in response to that, several places that will be opened to motorized snow vehicles that in the northern area that previously were not.
In the northern region, that means the Harding Lake, Lower Chattanooga, and Chena River sites could be open to snow machiners. Plager says another regulation calls for an increase in fees for special use permits.
The application fee would go up from $25 to $100 just to apply. And then, depending on the type of activity, you might have additional use fees imposed up to a high number, I think the maximum would be $1,000.
Plager says the fee increase is an attempt to recoup administrative costs linked to complicated activities, like hauling heavy equipment or commercial ventures. Another regulation bans horses from the steep, winding Angel Rocks Trail near Chena Hot Springs. Plager says it's a common sense move for the mile-and-a-half heavily hiked trail and probably won't be contested. This is the public's only chance to comment in person on the park regulations before they're sent to the Lieutenant Governor's office and eventually adopted. Planners will also accept written comments until the end of the month. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
The coal bunkers at the corner of Illinois and Phillips Field Road is standing at the heart of the latest dust-up between private enterprise and public concern. The structure, a long gray metal shed on stilts, was built 70 years ago to fuel nearby mining operations and a growing town. Roseanne Krukenberg is part of the family that owns the bunkers and the hardware and lumber business next door.
The coal bunkers is a structure that we own. We acquired it to allow us to get more ground for our company. And we have been working diligently to preserve and protect this building as a historical site. Our purpose and our strength has been to dismantle and restructure it elsewhere.
The hitch is, while the Krukenbergs own the bunkers, the railroad owns the land beneath. And the family says a crucial loan hinges on getting a new lease from the railroad. After waiting months to take up the issue, the railroad's board of directors in October put off okaying the lease. The Krukenbergs blame preservationists for that delay. Now the family says if the bunkers go, any opposition to the lease will also disappear. But many concerned groups and citizens want the bunkers to stay up. Clearly, part of their anxiety stems from a Fairbanks record of replacing historical buildings with parking lots. Architect Patricia Pearsall raised that point last week at a borough assembly meeting.
You know, we go, as Americans, we go to Europe. We go to other parts of the world, and we are in awe of their places. We're in awe of the history that they have, and yet when we come home, we tear ours down. As an architect, I love the beauty of that building, and some of you may think that they're ugly and dirty, but in my mind, they are beautiful.
Pearsall is just one of a number of concerned citizens and groups discussing the bunker's fate with the Krukenbergs. Many had their doubts when the family promised to find someone to take apart and reassemble the historical structure. But Roseanne Krukenberg says the family has already struck a deal.
We currently have a signed agreement with the Fairbanks Historic Preservation Foundation, where we have donated the building, and we're working out an amicable agreement to restructure them in the same area, if at all possible.
The foundation has a track record in restoration. It put together $1 million package to restore the riverboat Nenana. But the Krukenbergs say the deal hinges on whether the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors finally okay their lease at next week's meeting. Board member John Binkley says the deal is promising.
Well, I'm very encouraged by the reports that I've received of the local community getting together with the Krukenbergs to try and work out an agreement to preserve what really is an important part of Fairbanks' heritage. And I think it's a very positive solution and a win-win one for everybody in the community.
If the majority of the board agree with Binkley, the Krukenbergs get their lease, the loan, and the promise the bunkers will be moved by the end of May. But if the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors refuses the lease, the Krukenbergs say all bets are off. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Where many artists toil with brushes or paper to create their images, people who turn clay into pots are essentially building rocks. To do so, they gather together the result of years of erosion, shape it to their liking, then torch it at a temperature nearly hot enough to melt iron. Not long ago, a group of potters led by UAF professor Tom Rohr fired one of the nation's few Japanese Onagama kilns.
A pretty big operation, pretty big project due to the scale and the length of the firings, which are about 4 days long, where we stoke for about 4 days in intervals of about 10 to 12 minutes per stoke, so it's a constant round-the-clock ordeal.
The kiln itself is 22 feet long, built of brick and laid into a hillside, just the way Asian potters did thousands of years ago. Workers load the kiln, stacking pieces close together. But unlike most modern gas or electric kilns, this one uses wood. A trait Rohr says gives it a unique feel because the flame passes through a maze of pots, much like a river runs around rocks.
The process of the flame passing and the ash that lands on the pots will give surface coloration. And actually, the ash will form a glaze at the temperatures we fire to. So any ash that lands on the pots during the course of the firing, when we get up to temperature, we'll actually melt into a glaze.
Yeah.
Roar and the students fire the kiln about once a year. People work round the clock, taking six-hour shifts, watching the flames and gradually bringing the kiln up to temperature. Once done, they let it cool slowly for a week before they open it. Roar says the work emerges in a variety of brown hues, each of which tells a different story.
It's kind of like a photographer working with black and white, you know. They're interested in composition, and they work with shades of gray. And, you know, I'm working with the way flame passes over form in shades and hues of brown. But, you know, hey, if you break it down, there's yellow, green, red, pink, orange.
The event draws potters from across the state, many of whom jump at the chance to fire their work with wood. This year, Southern Illinois University professor Dan Anderson paid a visit. He says the work leaves a permanent snapshot of contemporary culture.
The pots are going to be around for literally thousands of years because of the stone-like quality of the material. And what they've enabled the archaeologists to do is to learn about civilizations from previous cultures, much more so than wood items or paper items or fabric because of their durability.
Anderson says few universities have such a kiln, and he's encouraged at the community effort that goes into firing this one. Liz Berry, who has a small wood-fired kiln of her own, says she just likes making art forms that see daily use.
I just like the idea of someone sitting down and having their morning breakfast tea or coffee out of one of my cups. And the fact that, you know, here's this stuff that came from the earth thousands of years ago, and it's turned into a real usable item. And it just feels good.
Barry's work and that of Roar and other potters is on display this month as part of Woodfire Alaska, a Fairbanks Arts Association show at Alaskaland. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Every quarter, the Fairbanks North Star Bureau releases a report tracking the local economy. The latest numbers for the fall reveal some downturns compared with last year. Banks have been steadily lending more dollars since 1990. This quarter, however, that figure dropped 16% from fall 95, meaning the institutions had less money out earning interest. But regional manager at Key Bank, Mike Milam, doesn't put much store in quarterly comparisons, and he says banks often sell off loans.
Banks sometimes sell their their residential mortgage portfolios, especially towards quarter end, and that's a national habit that people do, and I think most banks in the town do that. And if that happened to be at that quarter end, it would show a decrease in loan volume. But it also could see a very healthy economy if customers have enough cash to pay for their toys and their goodies.
Milam also points to how well bank stocks are performing on Wall Street, saying nationally and locally banks are healthy. But if some customers have cash for goodies, the quarterly report shows some are overspending. Personal bankruptcies doubled during the second quarter compared to last year, and more than twice as many businesses folded. But again, University of Alaska Fairbanks economics professor Bob Logan says there are other figures suggesting consumer spending is under control.
What we really need to do is look over the long term in comparison, again, to the terrible peak of the 80s. The mortgage defaults are way down. You look at the vacancy rates and in rental units and the housing prices recovering. You still see, in general, fairly strong fundamentals.
One of those fundamentals is cargo, and in recent years, the Fairbanks International Airport has waged a tough campaign to become a key gateway in international air cargo. But the economic quarterly shows 17% less cargo was handled at the airport this fall compared to the same time last year. Dave Carlstrom, marketing director for the airport, says much of that cargo is within state, and two emergencies inflated past cargo numbers. Fairbanks planes delivered most of the material to rebuild flood-devastated Allakaket, and pilots made crucial fuel airlifts for Red Dog Mine. Carlstrom doesn't worry about the quarterly's Alaska cargo figures. He says there's a more serious threat looming in the West for the airport's international cargo.
The increasing access to Russian airspace puts our Europe-Asia operations at risk, and that's 100% of what we have here in Fairbanks.
Carlstrom says European air carriers can shave 2 hours from their flight time by going over Siberia. that edge has already robbed Anchorage of all passenger flights going between Europe and Asia because they don't need to refuel. Only Alaska's reliability as a refueling stop has prevented air cargo carriers following suit. But Carlstrom says Russian cities are seriously aiming to take that business from Alaska as well. Only then, he says, will the Fairbanks airport suffer an economic blow worth worrying about. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Picture a family reunion. Friends, uncles, aunties, cousins, and other relatives gathering once a year to eat, visit, and listen to music. Billy gets out his guitar. Uncle Bergman pulls out his fiddle. And Auntie Virginia steps up to sing. There's cousins Jenny and Peter racing out to the dance floor doing the jitterbug. This is what you'll see at the Athabascan Old Time Fiddling Festival. Every November, fiddling enthusiasts gather in Fairbanks, the heart of interior Alaska, to hear musicians play. The music's rough. Sometimes the fiddles squeak, sometimes they're out of tune, but it fits in just fine in a land where people still live in log cabins and heat with wood. Bill Stevens, a Gwich'in Athabascan from Fort Yukon, was one of the organizers of the first festival. 3, 2, 1. Stevens has traveled all over the United States with his fiddle. He says the festival helped bring outside attention to the music. 3, 2, 1. Stephen says the music inspires dances like the schottische, polkas, jigs and reels, the two-step and duck dance. There's also the handkerchief dance, the verandee, and many others. As the native culture of the Athabascans mixed with that of their visitors, fiddling music became a way of life. Musicians once traveled to neighboring bush villages by dog team, stuffing their instruments deep in their sled bags. Today they travel by snow machine, but just like the old days, wherever they go, the people come out to dance. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher, reporting for The World.
This is the Alaska Native Athabascans from all the villages along the Yukon, and also from Canada. They come from just about every village, Fort Yukon, clear on, down to even the Yupiks from Lower Yukon, they're up here, and from Canada. So this is just not one particular village, but people from all over the villages in Alaska. So it's just fun for everybody. Athabascan fiddling been in isolation for a good many years, over 100 years it was in isolation, because how would people in Fairbanks know about us? Because we were in pockets in the villages, isolated there. We never come out, we never advertised. Arctic Village and all the Yukon, they had their own. So it was like that. So when the Fiddle Festival first became public in 1983 here, for everybody to see, we were on TV. So the world knows about us now.
Raven's showing me she's ready, okay? Because she's sitting on her bottom. She's listening.
Barbara Murray wants to learn about computers. Murray's a mother of two. Her four-year-old daughter, Sabina, just started school at the Golden Heart Head Start, where Murray volunteers through the Alaska Works program.
So I have never been in a computer program, but I think that's one of the things I'm going to do next. Because the kids got a computer in their room, and I don't know a darn thing about it. You know, I don't even know how to turn it on, so I better do something, yeah.
Murray works at Head Start while Sabina's in school. That way she doesn't have to worry about babysitters and can see firsthand how her child is doing. Head Start program manager Eileen Cummings says that's what it's all about. She says one of the program's goals is to employ parents.
It's our job to empower those parents to get off of welfare and get some skills to enable them to support themselves. And there seems to be an image of Head Start as a daycare or a freebie from the federal government. And it really isn't. It is a free service for families, but the end result and the goal of the program enables people to in most cases, stop taking assistance from the government.
And Cummings says it works. She points to parents like Murray who work at Head Start. Some have earned full-time jobs there. She also mentions the skills they learn, like how to manage their lives and be better parents. Head Start is a federal program with scores of regulations and requirements. Parent involvement is one of them. It's called shared decision making. Parents serve on committees ranging from hiring to grant writing.
With us having that responsibility to include them is also a responsibility to teach them how to do that stuff. And so it's pretty exciting to see they learn how to run meetings. They know what it's like to be interviewing somebody because they're on an interview committee. They know how hard it is to make a decision on who to hire and who not to. And so when they go for an interview, they've been on the other side of the fence.
Cummings says Head Start doesn't exist unless individuals make it happen in their own communities. Fairbanksons got together in the 70s and wrote the original grant. But times have been tough for the Golden Heart Head Start staff. After going through several administrative and location changes, the program moved into the old Denali Nursing Home building last year.
When this building was purchased, the dream was to have a one-stop shopping for families in need and in a central area on the bus line, and all of the pieces have kind of fallen into place. Head Start was the first program in this building. And then the collaboration between Adult Learning Programs of Alaska and Literacy Council of Alaska and RCPC and Head Start, we made the computer lab happen. And that's a community computer lab that focuses on literacy, job skills, life skills, and family literacy.
But even after moving to their dream home, Cummings wasn't sure Head Start would have a parent agency to take care of the program. It seemed like no local group was interested in taking over the tedious chore of facilitating it. But two groups did submit grants, and in August, the Adult Learning Programs of Alaska got the bid. Cummings says the two agencies have already been working together on projects like the computer lab, and Cummings says the two can now build a future together, something that wasn't such a sure thing for Head Start just a year ago. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
And in the library, Mr. P will be putting in a video for the bears. Some bear movies you can watch in there, okay? Remember, two people are only in the library at a time, okay? Two people. Read the penguins. There's two penguins in there at a time. So I will set up a VCR, and you can sit there and watch the movie. So watch the bear video, okay?
I like the
movie. Oh, we also have something for the flannel board.